Good morning. So, last time we were talking about how we handle writes with caches. So, when we started out, we were just thinking about all our caches, we're reading things from memory, we want to keep track of them, but the problem is our programs also write things to memory. And we have some decisions about how we handle that in our cache. And kind of the most natural idea would be, well, just like we did with reads, we should keep the values that are being written in the cache and not deal with the next level right away. That's kind of the most natural thing to do for locality, but that's a bit complicated to implement. So not all caches do this, so there's a kind of a decision. And one part of this decision is, well, when we have a miss and it's a write, do we actually put the value that's being written in the cache? And we can do that, but to actually implement that policy, we need to read some stuff from memory because almost never is the processor writing the whole cache block. So that means this write allocate policy turns our writes into a read from the next level of cache. We also have a second decision, which is, well, do we defer our updates to the next level on writes? And that's probably something that would be a good idea to do as far as taking advantage of locality, but it involves some extra complication in bookkeeping. That, you know, when we have some value that's modified in our cache, we need to make sure it eventually makes it to the next level. At the least, it makes it there when we forget about the value in the cache, because we never want to have a situation where you write a value to memory in your program, and then after a while, when you read that value back, you get something completely different. So to make sure we eventually update the value in the write-back policy, we have to add this dirty bit to tell us which things do we actually need to send to the next level, which have modifications, and which do we not. Because we don't want to sort of write all the time we're evicting something that would make kind of our normal cache misses for reads very expensive. The other option is what we call a write-through policy, where the cache says, well, I don't want to do that extra bookkeeping, and I'm going to hope there's not too many writes to make it a big problem. I'm just going to do the writes immediately. And we mentioned that this doesn't have maybe the performance impact you might, you know, think if we're going from our initial picture of, oh, the main memory and the higher levels of cache are much slower because we can kind of do this write in the background. So if there aren't too many writes, this can be relatively efficient, especially in kind of some of the common scenarios where, like, our first level cache might be write through, but our second level one would be write back. And after talking about our write policies, we talked about a completely different type of cache that sort of is usually used in tandem with our usual memory caches. And this was to cache page table entries. And it might seem like, well, isn't this kind of redundant because our page table entries are stored in memory, our caches cache stuff from memory, aren't we already caching it? The answer is yes, but not efficiently enough to make our memory translation fast. So we have a special sort of very purpose-optimized cache we call a TLB, which takes virtual page numbers and gives us the page table entry for that virtual page number. And by the page table entry, I mean the one at the last level, the one we can use to actually form an address. And we'll use the same type of cache design, except we've substituted our virtual page number for the memory address, and we'll have one page table entry per block instead of some bytes of memory in each block. This means that to do a lookup in this cache, we're going to split our virtual page number into a tag and an index. There's no offset bits because we have one entry per block, therefore zero offset bits. 2 to the 0 is 1. And otherwise, once we've made those substitutions, this cache works like our memory caches, but because of how page table entries are accessed, we can make this much smaller and therefore much, much faster. And this is how we make our sort of normal program memory accesses efficient. If we just try to have the page table entries be cached in our normal memory caches, well, we'd end up spending like 6 to 8 extra cycles on a typical modern laptop or desktop on each memory access. And by 6 to 8 extra cycles, I mean for the instruction accesses and the data accesses. And that's just not acceptable. So questions about things we covered last time? Before we sort of, we're going to go on and do a bit of more review on TLBs. Yeah?
When we have a TLB, we still also cache our,
So when we have the TLB, are we going to still store the page table entries in the cache? Most likely, yes. I could imagine processors having some memory system where they don't do that, but that seems like extra work to implement. And certainly when the OS modifies the page table entries, that's going to use the normal data cache. Other questions? Okay. And one logistics note, there is a quiz released tonight, due next week. I know we've had a couple weeks without quizzes, one for because of the spring break and one because of chaos before the spring break. But there is one released tonight, due Tuesday. So last time when we finished off, we revealed, you know, for our 2 to the 12 byte pages, which imply 12 page offset bits. If we had this virtual address, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, well, we'd split that into VPN 0x12 and page offset 0x345. And when we're using a TLB to complete the translation for that, we're gonna take our VPN . We're going to split it up into a TLB index and a TLB tag. And this all goes through the TLB. Which I should write clearly. And we're going to get out of that a page table entry, which has a physical page number and also like a writable, executable bits and all that other information. And ultimately we're going to take this page offset and combine it to form our actual physical address to access. So that's our normal memory access process. So, let's do a little exercise. We have the same TLB set up in the same size of pages, and I have a table here of some memory accesses the program did. And let's assume our TLB is initially unpopulated, so everything is invalid in it, so all the 4 of the entries. And question here is, which of these accesses will be a TLB hit or a miss? And what will be in the TLB when we complete this sequence of accesses? So I'll give you a couple minutes to work through that. You can check I encourage you to check with your neighbors to see if you agree on what should go on.
Places.
Who'd like some more time? You people? Okay. Okay, so who thinks we have exactly zero hits? exactly one hit, exactly two, three, four, five or more hits. Going for that. Okay. So we seem to have a consensus. So this is my work through version of it, and I'm just pointing out, saying that we're going to store page table entries. I'm labeling the page table entries by their VPNs just to track them. I'll get into like what's actually in the page table entries in a bit. And we tell which set these page table entries go to with the index bit. And the index bit here is, well, this is our page offset. So our VPN is 440. And that is 0100000000. And we have one index bit, so there it is. So that's index 0. For 440, it's also 0 for FFFFFE, but not for FFFD. And also 0 for 664. So what ends up happening is we access 440. Oh, and I was a bit inconsistent here, but should do. So we access virtual page 440. The offset doesn't matter because that's not part of the TLB lookup. That's just a step afterwards. The page offset, I should say. Not a TLB offset. And we're going to get a miss. We load that page in. Then we have a write to the same page. Same lookup. That it's a write also doesn't matter for the TLB. It's going to matter for some permission checks, but that's all after the TLB lookup. Because the TLB is not storing the data, remember, it's storing the page table entry. So that's a hit. We have a read from this page we haven't accessed. We're going to load that into set 0 because of what the index bit says. We fortunately have room for two page table entries in set 0. Then to the same page, that's going to be a hit. We have a new page because that's a new page number, and it maps to set 1. That's a miss. We access 664, and here we have to evict something. And when we figure out what we're evicting, we're going to apply the LRU replacement policy. So we just used 7FFFFE. So we're not going to evict that. We're going to evict the other option, which is 440's virtual page table entry. Then we unluckily access that virtual page table entry, virtual page numbers, page table entry again, which is going to be another miss, and we're going to load it in, and now the 7FFFE page is the least recently accessed, and then we finally have a hit. So we're going to get three hits. So questions on how figured this out? And as for the final contents, I kind of wrote them out in a short form. Here's kind of our, you know, kind of what's actually going to be in the TLB. So we have two sets with two blocks. Each block is a page table entry. We have a valid bit, which I've labeled as V. We have the tag, which is going to be everything but the least significant bit of the virtual page number, which I've just computed here. And we have the page table entry, which is going to have a physical page number and all the permission bits. We also need to keep track of the LRU information, which I've indicated by just yes or no here, but probably that would be a bit for each set, indicating which of the two ways of the set are at least recently used. Questions? So this is going to be, it's my planned conclusion of talking about TLBs in lecture. There's going to be an upcoming assignment in a bit on TLBs, where basically we're going to implement something that looks like a TLB in a software simulation in a way where we could use it alongside your page table implementation. We're not going to have you actually do that because we want to have the assignments be independent, so problems on the page table assignment don't cause problems on this assignment, the feature assignment, but that's sort of the design of our feature assignment. Okay, so then for our next big topic in this course, we're going to talk about multi-threaded programming. And we kind of alluded to this since we talked about processes already, which were running multiple things at a time. And we're going to talk about running multiple things at a time, potentially in the same process, in one process. And I'm going to talk about kind of, there's two classes of reasons why you would decide to do this. And you might say, why do we need justification for this? Doesn't everyone use multiple threads? I think one thing that should come up when we talk about threading is that maybe you want to avoid it. We're going to talk about how to use it correctly and how things work, but one I think overall goal you might set is, you know, maybe this isn't worth it and we should try to. One practical not use threads. But we're going to talk about how to use threads because they are useful, they are used a lot, perhaps even when they shouldn't be, and there's usually kind of two classes of reasons why programs are using threads. So one class is what I'll call concurrency, that we have different operations that we're doing within one program that are relatively independent of each other. So if we have a web server, we might have one thread for each user that's connected to the web server. But these are not separate processes because, you know, it's one web server which has shared data. Maybe there's some stuff that one user accesses that other users see. We want to make that sort of all happen in one big program. But what each user is doing is mostly independent of the other users, and we want it to run independently, kind of like separate processes, but that share a bunch of extra stuff. We can have the same kind of idea for, you know, tabs in a web browser, that we want one thread per page, because what each page is doing is basically independent, and we want to run separately, but we're going to need to coordinate between the tabs, because there are things where sort of what the overall web browser is doing, you know, matters, and we don't want to like actually have necessarily a separate process for each thing. Or if we have a program that's like playing audio and reading input, maybe it would be convenient for writing that program to write the playing audio part and have that run just as a kind of like a separate program at the same time as the reading keyboard. So something I'll note about this concurrency idea is that none of the things I talked about here are cases where I want multiple threads because I want to take advantage of hardware. This is just, I want multiple threads because this is a more convenient way of programming these things. So it's not about multiple cores, it's about, we think that this is a more convenient way of programming it, because you could write a program with one thread that plays audio and reads from the keyboard at the same time. But that might be a lot more annoying, because you basically have to have your program check for some keyboard input, play the next bit of audio, check for some keyboard input, play the next bit of audio in this one thread. And kind of the idea of this concurrency reason for using threads is that it would be more convenient to write a loop that plays audio and a loop that checks for keyboard input, and just have the operating system run them at the same time for you using the sort of context switching idea we've seen already. And you do that even if you were knew you were always on a single core, because that's just easier to program, let the operating system handle figuring out when to play the audio, when to check for keyboard input. The other big reason that you might use threads is because we do have more hardware resources we want to use. If we have a single process doing one thing at a time, and we have multiple cores, multiple processors, we're not going to be able to really take advantage of that So that would be a reason to use threads. And often we're doing one task with multiple threads, all helping compute that single task. So in this case, this is not something we're doing for programmer convenience, because really the most natural way to express the computation we're doing would be as a single program that runs one thing at a time. But we want to use the resources we have available to complete that faster, and I'll call this idea parallelism. So we're doing one task across multiple threads because our assumption is that we have multiple cores or multiple processors or multiple machines that can all help us complete that task, you know, in pieces that run at the same time, running parallel to make it run faster. Questions about our motivations for why we might want threads. Okay, so we're going to talk a bunch about sort of multiple threads in one program. So what we've seen so far in this class is that we have a process. It has some open files, it has a process ID, it has some stuff loaded in memory, and we have one thread with a stack and registers and a program counter, some other state that is tracked by the program in the OS. In a multi-threaded process, we still have some open files and a process ID and some loaded code and some global variables, but we also have multiple instances of our thread data, our stack, our registers, our program counter. And these multiple instances share the same process ID and the same open files and so on. And we're going to look at the Unix pthreads API for manipulating threads. Not the only one, it's just the one that's probably most commonly used on Linux-like systems in C. So what does that look like? And let's look at an example of creating some threads. So here I have two functions, computePy and printClassList. And I'm going to run them in a separate thread, and at the same time, I'm going to have my main function continue running. So when we run this, we're going to have three things running concurrently, potentially. So assuming that printClassList and computePy don't immediately manage to exit, we'll have our main thread running while printClassList is running, while computePy is running. And these will be not separate processes like we've seen before in some similar examples. These will be threads of the same process, meaning that, for example, if I had a global variable, all of this code would have the same global variable that they could access. And we'll talk about later about, well, is that, what does that actually mean? Is that actually safe? But you know, it's not a separate process like we've seen with fork. Like, all the memory is shared, though the new threads have their own stack and therefore their own local variables. Just like when we call a function normally, that function call has its own local variables. So let's talk about this pthread create call. So our first argument is a thread identifier. So this is the thread equivalent of a process ID. Something which causes people confusion here is that, like POSIX memoline, this function returns its return value kind of in a combination of using the actual return value and by filling in a pointer you pass it. So in this case, we have a pthread t, which is basically a thread ID, and we're passing in a pointer to that the function will fill in when it's successful. The actual return value of the function is the error number, which is 0 if there's no error. And the other big argument we have is the function to run in the thread. So when the thread starts, unlike fork, we're not going to copy the current thread. That would be very confusing and also logistically difficult. Instead, we're going to have our library that implements pthread create. It's going to run the function we specify in the new thread. And this function has to have the prototype that it returns a void star and takes a signal void star argument. If you don't want to use an argument, well, too bad. It wants you to have one. If you don't want to return anything, well, too bad. You have to return a void star. And like with kind of a main in for our processes, when this function returns, the thread automatically exits. And I have two arguments I would pass null here. The first argument is something called thread attributes, which is where you set extra settings for the thread. We'll see some examples of those later. But in most practical cases, you'll just pass null, which means just use the default settings for making a thread. And this second argument is the function argument. And this ends up being passed as that argument to the function we supplied. So this is the first call to compute pi. So questions on our pthread create call? Okay. So let's have here a simple example with pthread create. So I print about to start the thread. I call pthread create, running this print message function with the argument null. And in this print message function, it prints in the thread and then returns. And then I print done starting thread. And on my machine, this outputs in the thread, the thing that the thread I created outputs, about 4% of the time. 96% of the time, it just doesn't appear in the output anymore. So what's happening? What's going on? Any ideas? Like, why is it only happening 4% of the time? Yeah.
Does the program exit before the thread finishes?
Yes. And you might say, wait a moment, you didn't say to exit anywhere here. But the rule in C is that returning from main, returning from main is like calling exit with the return value from main. And if you don't specify a return value from main, it's like calling exit with zero. And exit, interesting. Exit is exit the whole process. Gets rid of the whole process. So what happens is I'm having my main thread runs. We call pthread create. That creates this thread. And eventually this main thread exits. And if that exit happens before, it would run the printf. We don't see the output. If that exit instead happens later, then we do see the output. So like with our examples with multiple processes, this is dependent on when the OS exactly does context switches, and therefore also like everything else going on in the machine, like are we having input handled? Do we have other programs to run? How many cores do we have available? And so you have this kind of pseudo-random behavior here. That's what's going on here. And I'm going to call this a race. Basically, we have a race between our main thread and our new printmessage thread, and whoever wins affects our outcome. And we're going to see this happen in a bunch of other contexts where we have two threads where their exact timing is really going to influence what our program's behavior is. And generally, we're going to want to eliminate these. And we'll talk about mechanisms for doing that, a lot. I'm going to start with, how do we fix this particular problem? And there's kind of two strategies, one of which I recommend, the other of which I wouldn't, but I will show you. So what we're really missing here is that we didn't do something like wait PID. We didn't wait for the thread to finish before actually exiting the program. So we can do that. And the call to do that is called pthread join. Pthread join is basically the equivalent of wait PID, but for a thread. And pthread join takes this second argument. This is where to place the thread return value. So like wait PID has a place to put the exit status information, pthread join has a place to put the return value of the thread. In this case, I'm passing null because I don't care. So in this case, this will wait for the newly started thread to finish before actually returning from main, and therefore the process will consistently output in the thread. Now, the output of this process is still not going to be consistent because we have two possibilities. We could have in the thread output and then done starting thread, or we could have done starting output and then in the thread, because it depends on when does the OS decide to run the main thread versus the new thread, or if they're running actually at the same time, like if we have multiple cores, like which one goes faster? We don't know, so either of those are faster. But at least we'll always output in the thread in this case. So questions? Here, yes? Question, what's stored in the pthread T type of? So the designers of the pthreads API intended it to be implemented by lots of different people. So it's very deliberate that we don't get to know what's in pthread T because the idea is it could vary between systems. On Linux, it's essentially a long that is probably a memory address encoded some way. Does that answer your question? Question, if we wanted to guarantee that in thread was printed first, could we move the pthread join up? Yes. Absolutely. Other questions? Follow-ups? Okay. So I said this is the way for fixing this problem that I would recommend. I will talk about another way just so we understand how things work. So another option is I can exit the main thread, the thread that initially starts the program, without exiting the program. So pthread exit says exit the current thread, returning the specified value. So just like returning from the thread's main function, from the thread function, like exit the thread, returning a value, we can explicitly call pthread exit. And because exiting the main thread, doesn't exit all the process here, this will actually also always print in the thread. So in this example, it could be the case that our main thread exits, but as long as we aren't exiting by returning from main or calling exit, that doesn't exit the whole process. And kind of the way threads work that is that we always have a thread, it's just that one of the threads is started by the OS for us. And that's the one that runs main. The only reason that returning for main exits the whole program is because the thing calling main, you know, does something that exits the whole program when it gets control back from main return. It's not because there's something special about the main thread. Just another thread in the program, and as far as the threading library is concerned, that thread can just exit, and that doesn't stop the other threads from running. Some questions about our not recommended solution. Yeah?
What's the argument for
pthread? It's the return value of the thread. So if we were pthread joining, it would be what would be we would be able to retrieve. What's the type of the second argument to pthread join? This is a void star star, because the return value is a void star. Yeah? If we're just exiting immediately, why would we ever need the return value? What do you mean, just exiting immediately? Doesn't that close the main process? So, we have a process with multiple threads. Pthread exit just gets rid of one of these threads. But it doesn't close the whole process. As long as we have threads left, the process is still around. Does that answer your question? So if I put a global variable, someone else could use it. What do you mean put a global variable? The question is the return value of pthread exit. How can you ever use it? So in this case, probably you can't because nothing can join this thread, but it's there because in general we could call join on the thread that calls pthread exit. Does that answer your question? Yeah. When we create a new thread, it doesn't create a new process? That is right. Right, we are creating this multi-threaded process situation where we're sharing a bunch of the sort of global data of the process with our new thread. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So we have these two calls, pthread join, waits for a thread and copies the return value into some value we pass in, or if we don't pass in a null pointer, and pthread accepts the thread, setting its return value. It's kind of like exit, but only for the current thread, not for the whole process. So something I'll note about return values and error checking in general is that all the pthread functions have this pattern where they return whether or not there's an error. And they do this by returning different return values that aren't zero to indicate the type of error. So for example, for pthread create, it will return the constant e again if we're out of memory. It will return the constant e and val if you pass in attributes that don't make sense. And there's something similar in the manual pages for the other pthread functions. On my slides, I'm often not going to show actually checking these return values just to make my slides shorter. That definitely doesn't mean you shouldn't do that. Especially for things like pthread create, where obviously we could be out of memory at pretty much any time, and you probably want your program to at least print a message about that. Okay, so let's go through some examples of doing arguably useful things with threads, and we're going to look at doing something that's in the parallelism category. And the thing I'm going to be doing is summing up an array of 1,024 values. Probably if we wanted this to actually be faster, it would need to have like, a million times more values. But just to keep our code simple, we'll have just 1,024. And here's a strategy where I'm just using the things we've seen already to implement that. So I have two functions here, sum front and sum back. The sum front function sums the first half of our global array and stores the result in results of zero, a global variable array, index zero. And sum back sums the other half of the array and stores the result in index one of that global array. And I have this kind of master function here called sumAll, which creates our two threads, one running sum front, one running sum back, waits for them to finish, and then reads the global variables that they have written to, and we know they're written to because they finished, and we know they finished because pthread join wouldn't return yet if they hadn't. Puts the partial sums together and returns that result. And a big reason this works is that when we make a new thread, it still has all the same global variables. So all these global variables, it's part of the same process, same global variables, so we can share that data that way. Some questions about my sum with global variables? Yes?
So just to be clear, this is the reason this is valuable is because it's faster than calling both methods individually.
So the reason this would be valuable is because it would be faster than calling both methods individually. So in this example, it probably wouldn't because pthread create is not free. But if, I multiplied 1024, instead of having 1024 elements, we had enough, it would be faster. Does that answer your question? So whether this is faster or not depends on sort of how fast it is to create the threads versus the advantage we're getting from presumably having multiple cores that can simultaneously do our two sets of additions. Other questions? I saw something. Okay. And if we don't have multiple cores, it's slower every time, no matter the size. Other questions? So we have these global variables, and there's something annoying here we're going to want to fix, which is that I wrote a lot of redundant code to make this work. Sure, it'd be nice not to do that. And other thing you might notice is that I'm passing my return values in this global variable, even though maybe I really should be using this return value here to do it and then retrieving it via here. I did this in this example partly to illustrate that, yes, the global variables really are shared. This is not like fork, where they're copies. They're really shared. And partly because we're going to have examples where we don't necessarily join and we still want to share our values. And to kind of think of what's going on is that if we think of our program, we have our global variables stored in the program's memory, and when we start these two threads, they're going to get their own stack. So we have our main thread stack, and I say main thread meaning the thread that's running main, and presuming that thread is the one which called sumAll, we're then going to have our two new thread stacks, which are going to be allocated separately but in the same address space, so the same page table is going to have multiple stacks at different addresses, and we'll have one page table for our whole process. And we have the thread where each of these two new threads have their own registers that include pointers to their own stacks and their own program counter, which are going to be running two different functions. And these threads are going to be able to modify and read these same global variables because they all have the same sort of memory mapping because it's all the same process. Questions about what's going on with our memory when we're running these two threads? So let's first solve the kind of most obvious problem that we have a lot of duplicated code here. And I'm going to solve that by making a generic sum function that uses the argument. And in this case, I'm going to do a kind of nasty trick in that I'm going to shove an integer into a pointer and take it out again. So this is making a pointer to memory address I, so memory address 0 or 1. And this is get the memory address of argument as an int. So here, I'm not using the pointer as a pointer. I'm using it as storage for an integer, where I'm pretending the memory address is 0 or 1, even though obviously that's not a real memory address, not a valid memory address. And this is something that you'll see relatively common in real C code that uses void star. There's many arguments about whether this is a good thing or not, but it's definitely something you'll see programs do. So I'm just shoving a pointer in our void star because that's the only type that pthread create allows me to use. And I don't really want to pass a pointer, I really want to pass a number. So in this case, I'm starting one thread with the address 0, which we'll extract the number 0 from, and one with the address 1. And then it does some computations with that, what I call the ID number, to compute our index ranges, and also to compute where in the results array we write. So now, instead of having a sum front and sum back, I have one function where if I pass in 0, it does the sum front. If I pass in 1, it does sum back. And I can pass in that value by passing it as my last argument to pthread create. Okay, so questions? So I've shown passing one value to the threads, and a complaint you might have is, gosh, you know, if I were writing a generic sum function, I'd really want to write, you know, some thread, I'd want to pass in, like, the start, the end, the result index, you know, could we, you know, I really want to have something that, where I don't just have to squeeze everything into one parameter. How do I make that work? And a very common pattern to do that is that we will make a struct to represent the arguments to our threads. We will allocate space for that struct. In this example, we're allocating space as a local variable here. And I'll pass a pointer to that struct into the thread. This is a very common pattern you'll see, and why that single pointer that pthread create lets us pass is sufficient for what we need to do, why we don't need an API which lets us pass, you know, more arguments in. And in this example, I'm also doing this trick where I store the thread's result in the struct, and then I retrieve it out of the struct at the end. Yes?
So these are the start and end attributes of the thread how is that getting, like, parsed? Because are those names that you've made up?
Are the start and end attributes of the front infrastructure, are those names I made up?
Like, could those attributes be anything and I can give any? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yes, so I define the struct there. Yeah, so I can put whatever I want in it. Yeah?
So the structs are stored in the main thread stack, right?
So the structs are stored in the main thread stack? Yes.
And so then you're passing a pointer to the main thread stack to the other threads?
Yeah, so we're passing a pointer to the main thread stack to the other threads. So I have this picture here. So it is in fact the case that those threads are accessing another thread stack, and that is 100% okay, as long as we make sure the value in that other thread stack stays around. Now, in this case, how do we know the value stays around? Well, this value here, it goes out of scope here, and it goes in scope here, and we know the thread won't exit before it goes out of scope because we have this pthread join sort of make sure the threads exit before info is out of scope. So if we didn't do that, we definitely have a problem, because we'd be accessing info start and info end after it went out of scope. But in this case, the pthread join assures that even though it's on another thread stack, it stays in scope the entire time the thread might be accessing. And because we have this one address space where the stacks are just stored at different locations, it's not a problem to access values on another thread stack, and that's relatively common for cases like this. Questions? Our scenario here. So something that might still be disappointing that probably, you know, your software engineering classes would complain about here is that, we have this global variable here that is hard-coded all over the place, and that makes this not a very reusable function. Couldn't we make this function, you know, not rely on a global variable? And the answer is absolutely. And I can just pass a pointer to my array, to the threads, through that struct. So I can just add extra fields for everything I want to pass around, both in both directions in this case. And just pass whatever values I need to the threads. And so what we'll end up with, you know, is that we'll have our info array that the other threads will access, and that will have a pointer, just actually two separate pointers. Maybe kind of disappointing, but we have to have different values passed to each of the threads, but two separate pointers to some values array that's passed into some all, which could be stored anywhere. Could be on the stack, could be on the heap, could be in a global variable. We don't care. We have one function that works no matter where it is. Questions so far? Okay, so far I've shown this pattern where we're using threads where we have kind of our driver thread, what I'm calling the main thread, that, you know, sets up the threads and then waits for them to do their work. And that's often, very often, what we want to do, but sometimes we want to really take advantage of the fact that threads don't need to be doing the same thing, you know, doing all coordinating with each other, and we want to sort of do an operation and wait for it to finish, or check if it's finished later. So let's do that. So here, instead of having a sumAll function, I have a startSumAll, and a finish them all. And the idea is that we start the sum, and it's going to finish in the background, and sometime later we'll collect the result. So in this example, rather than putting my thread info on the stack, I allocate it on the heap and return it from a start function, and then you pass it to the finish function, and it can use that information to actually complete the threads. Now to make this work, I needed to have the argument to pthread join of what threads to join. And so I just said, well, I have this info struct, why don't I just put it there? And this kind of allows our sum function to be like, start this thing in the background, and then finish it later. And probably for summing an array, this is not what you do, but there's a lot of other tasks you might have in a program where you want to like start something, have it run in the background, check on it later. And this kind of pattern is a way you can implement that with threads. And so what we'll end up with here is that our two threads will have that info array, but now it's on the heap. Yeah. So it doesn't matter what the main thread does. It doesn't go out of scope until we call the finish function, which makes sure it's OK because it calls pthread join before actually freeing that array. Questions? About my examples of my sort of common patterns for using threads, you know, and sort of navigating the issue of, wait, how do we deal with this void star thing and actually get useful with it. Okay, so, as sort of a discussion question, let's do, so here I have some code that uses threads, so I'm going to start a thread that creates a string, computes a string, and returns it. I retrieve the return value of the thread and print it out. What's wrong with this code? There's something where this code will not work very well. What is it? And as a second question, how do we fix it? And by fix it, I mean, let's fix it under the assumption that in the quote-unquote real version of the code, we would want to do other things here while the thread string is being computed. Right. It's not going to be acceptable to just eliminate the threads from this problem, which is definitely the easiest fix. Yeah. It's just call compute string instead of the making a thread. So anyone curious to tell me what's wrong, what's going to go wrong when I, you know, makes this code not work out very well? Yeah?
Is it that the string array isn't a pointer, so when you pass it in the compute string, it doesn't actually get changed when it's returned?
Okay, so if your question is, oh, here we're passing in an array, how does that work? So the rules in C actually let this work out well, assuming compute string is declared something like, something like this. This is fine, because an array will get converted to a pointer to its first element. Yes, but assumption is declared like that, so in that case, that is a valid way to pass something that where compute string can modify the string. I think there are ways where it couldn't, but yes. our assumption is to declare that, so that is not, in fact, a problem. We can, in fact, pass another thing that way. We don't need an ampersand. And that's just a special rule with how arrays work in C. But good question, yeah. Like, how does this compute string function work? That's going to be how it works. So we can make it work by declaring it correctly. Okay, other ideas? Okay, yeah. Okay, so you're saying, what about this? This seems suspicious here. So on a very technical perspective, what we should be doing is we should have a void star temp. We should pass in that temp and then sort of assign string pointer to that temp. Because conceptually, it might be the case that the representation of a void star and a char star are different. Now, fortunately for us, on every system you'll ever use, that's not the case. That a char star and void star are represented the same way, so it doesn't matter that we're asking it to write to the wrong type. Asking it to write to a char star instead of a void star. But it's a good question, like, because that does seem suspicious. And indeed, in a very technical sense, the C standard might say, don't do that. But that is not actually the biggest problem here. Even though, yeah, it's a C problem. It's not what we're supposed to be doing. There's a bigger problem here. And maybe to help realize this bigger problem, let's think of, we can have actually the same problem occur here. If I replace this with char star string pointer equals create string null. There would actually be the same problem if I didn't use multiple threads. Now, a version of the same problem that would be less likely to be noticed, but still the same problem. Yeah. So it's because char string is on the stack and in the thread, and it goes out of scope. So this char string here, you know, the string is in scope here, and at this point it is out of scope. So the memory for the string no longer exists. And you might say, but we're returning it. Returning a pointer to the memory that goes away as we return it. So string pointer successfully points to our stack, which has been completely deallocated because the thread exited and was joined. So that's our problem here. Can someone tell me what's a fix? How can I make this not be broken? Yeah. Okay. So we could use this argument here. We could pass in a pointer to some storage for the string, rather than having it be allocated on the stack by the create string function. Yeah, that is definite one solution. Another possible solution is we could malloc the string in create string and return a pointer to that malloced memory, then they would have to free it eventually, but that's a much easier to deal with. Questions? Okay, so something to note about pthread join is that, like I kind of showed pthread join, is this is a thing we do when we want to wait for a thread or get its return value. It's a little more mandatory than that. Because it allows collecting the return value, if you have a thread that you could join and you don't join it, it's just the The pthread library is just going to be keeping that return value around, even if it's just null, forever, until you join. And that's a memory leak. So if you have a program which starts threads all the time, and it runs for a day, you'll eventually be very disappointed if you aren't calling pthread join. So if you want to avoid this, you should always join, or there's another option that the pthread library has called detaching a thread to mark it as not joinable. And if it's not joinable, the library doesn't need to keep the return value around, there's no memory leak. So how does detaching work? Well, the simplest way of doing it is once you have a pthread ID, you call the pthread detach function, and that just says, I don't want to ever join this thread. When it exits, just forget about it. Yeah?
Is memory allocated in different threads stored in the same page table for the process?
Is memory allocated in different threads stored in the same page table for the process? Yes, there's a single page table for the whole process, for all threads. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so this, so calling this marks the thread is not joinable, and you might say, okay, so that's nice. Do I really need to, like, create the thread and then set that setting? Couldn't we, like, have the thread start that way? And the answer is, yes, we can. Because we have that attributes field that we show start has null. This is one of the uses of it, is that you can start a thread and say, I want to start this thread, and I'm never going to join this thread. Please don't keep information about it around after it exits. Just, you know, ignore it. And we can do that by, you know, creating this pthread @t object, and there's a bunch of functions for manipulating it, and one of them lets us set whether it's initially detached or whether it's joinable. So if it's detached, we cannot call join on it, but also we don't have to call join on it, which is not true if it's not detached. Also, I can use the same functionality to set the stack size of the thread. So you might say, how big is the stack we're allocating? I've shown that we have an extra thread stack. How big is it? Well, there's a default, and the default varies. If you actually want to specify it, you can. So questions are threads. Okay, so for our last few minutes, I'll introduce what will be our next big topic. This is, we had this example where we have this non-deterministic behavior. And I mentioned that this is going to come up a whole bunch of times, that we have multiple threads, and that creates non-determinism. And we already saw this with multiple processes, but usually this was kind of trivial, right? It was, the output would be in a different order, and that wouldn't be a big deal in practice. But here we have shared global variables that are going to have different values, and that can often be a big problem. So, as an example, that we're going to start with, let's say I have a server that manages a whole bunch of ATMs and implements commands that it receives from the ATMs with withdrawal and deposits. And my server basically runs a loop where it receives requests and does one of the operations and, you know, does some arithmetic based to do a deposit or withdrawal based on information it receives from the ATMs. And maybe we run multiple copies of this because we want to take advantage of having multiple cores, or because we want to, you know, deal with maybe that this save account updates op function needs to write to the disk, and we want to do multiple writes to the disk at once and have the OS handle that for us. So we have multiple copies of this. And in my deposit, I have this just sort of account balance update. And we just have multiple instances of that run for the same account. Well, you know, joint account, two people depositing at the same time. And we can end up with a scenario where our two deposits, we say our initial balance is 100, we add 50 to that to get 150, and we write 150 to the balance. And in the second deposit, our initial balance is 100, say we add 20 to that to get 120, and then we write 120 to the balance. And we've forgotten about the $50 deposit. So we're going to talk about how to fix that problem as our main topic for the next week. How to deal with generally coordinating threads safely so things like this do not happen. We'll talk a second about what's going on here.